are they all, Mama? Cathy stared. In spite of Casper's whispered protestations, Emil had taken out an announcement in the Times, and accordingly, the grounds were filled with customers past and present. Shop hands from seasons past had come to show their respects. The wives and daughters of those who had been lost along the way had come to catch a glimpse again of the gilded world their husbands and fathers once left behind. Beneath hanging hawthorn, Frances Kesey was dressed in funereal grey. Sally Ann, who later declared that Papa Jack's was a life of colour and he did not deserve to see only sadness on this his final day, had come in vaudeville black with lurid sapphire and emerald brocade. "Are you ready?" Wordlessly Casper nodded. Together they emerged onto the cold, hard ground between the graves. Martha, dressed in one of Nina's black gowns, cringed from the wind. Cathy took her hand, thinking her still a little girl, but Martha did not resist. In turn she took Casper's, and, to Cathy's astonishment, he did not resist either. Cathy looked up. Sally Ann was right. There ought to have been patchwork horses drawing chariots of fire. The Pegasi ought to have been set loose to cavort in the open skies, and to hell with the damage they caused when their motors stopped whirring and they came crashing back down. Ballerinas ought to have twirled en pointe, while every tree in Highgate Cemetery was smothered in the tendrils of spreading paper vines. The trees, the sky, the world seemed so ordinary today. Behind them, Emil and Nina were emerging from the hearse, their boys dressed in miniature black suits. Emil, whose own suit seemed suddenly too small, waited while the pallbearers lifted the coffin out of the carriage. "Are you certain you can do it?" Cathy asked. Casper's eyes had not left the coffin for a second. "Do you want honesty?" "Always, Casper." "Then I'm far from certain. But I'm certain that, if I don't, I would never forgive myself. So I'll stand at Emil's side, if only for today." Cathy led Martha along the frost-hardened trail, as an honour guard grew up along the wild, untended banks. At its end, the earth was open and the gravediggers standing by. Cathy stood at its head, staring into the ground that would soon swallow Jacob's Godman whole. She had been telling herself, it's only his husk, only what he left behind. And he left behind so much more back in our emporium. But seeing the earth made thoughts like those seem so facile. Jacob's Godman was gone. "Mama, there's something changed in Papa today. Did you see? He held my hand in the carriage." There were so few excuses she could make. The years had been a long litany of explaining her husband away, and Martha was not a girl any longer. She could not be persuaded to believe what her heart held as untrue. "Today is a strange day." They were coming along the trail now. Lean, angular Casper, still walking with a limp. Ragged, rotund Emil, who looked as if he hadn't slept in nights. Behind them, two hired hands bore the second half of the coffin. "I remember being scared of him, up in that workshop. Can you believe that? Warm, fuzzy Uncle Emil and Papa, just being Papa. And then there was Papa Jack, big as both of them, and with those eyes and those hands and that... would you call it hair, Mama? Tangled and matted, like he hadn't had a wife in a century or more. But yes, Martha, I'd call it hair." Martha grinned. "I was scared of him, too. The day I turned up, they took me up to his workshop. And he fixed me with those eyes and asked me those questions and... somewhere along the way, it clean melted away. He stitched you a bear out of spider silk. You lay in his hands that day you were born. Do you know, by then I wasn't afraid at all. I would have let him carry you away." Cathy paused. "Here they come." The funeral procession had arrived. In a succession of stutters and false starts, Casper and Emil guided the coffin to the ground at the graveside. Moments later, the cowled undertaker stepped in and began to attach cords. The graveside was growing crowded at last. There were faces here that Cathy knew, but so many more to which she could put no name. She reached out for Caspar, guided him to the grave beside her. "Are you?" Caspar gave her a knowing look. "My papa was the heaviest of men." The crowd had gathered. The undertakers were in place. The coffin hung, suspended over the grave, and then, inch by inch, Papa Jack vanished into the ground. At the head of the grave, Emil waited nervously for his moment. The silence around him was absolute, and, with his boys at his side, he began. "My papa was a simple man. My papa was a great man. My papa was my world. The emporium he created occupies such a place in all of our hearts that we would not be the people we are without it. And that is why we have joined here today, to commit my papa to the earth, to give our thanks that he was part of this world at all." "Papa Jack is gone, but the emporium lives on in all of us, in our hearts, and in the memories that exist out there, of everyone who ever shopped in the emporium halls, the boys and girls and the games that they played." Cathy saw his eyes roaming the crowd until they found his brother, whose head was still bowed over the grave. "Our papa's work lives on as long as the Emporium does. As long as we're making toys. As long as we're..." His voice threatened to break, but he conquered it again. "Keeping magic in the world. Never forgetting we used to be small. Making the world better. One toy at a time." From the clouds above, thin snowflakes started to fall. They sifted through the cemetery trees, dusting the graves, but they were not paper, so it was not right. Emil helped his boys throw handfuls of dirt onto the coffin. The grave diggers were waiting to do their task, but soon all of those gathered were tossing in more handfuls. In that way, Papa Jack's coffin disappeared from view. At Kathy's side, Martha threw a handful of earth. Cathy did the same, removing her glove to feel the frozen dirt on her fingers. She turned to deposit some into Casper's hand, but there was another figure between them now. Somebody sidled up from behind to make his offering. He was old as Papa Jack had been, with the look of a weasel, and the only hair he had left hanging in a curtain of grey around the back of a scalp mottled with age. The suit he was wearing was freshly bought, and the raw red of his skin gave Cathy the impression that he had spent long days scouring away the filth in which he ordinarily lived. He smelt of cheap talc and peppermint lotion, and, when he looked up, she saw that one of his eyes was made entirely of glass. "Are you the son?" His voice had the same inflection as Papa Jack's, of a language learned long into life and peppered with old harsher sounds never forgotten. It took Caspar a moment to realize it was him to whom the stranger had spoken. "My name is Caspar," he said. "Tell me, did you know my father?" "A long time ago, and half a world away. But yes, I am proud to say that I did. You might say that I was his apprentice, though perhaps he would not himself have used such a word. I am sorry for your lost boy. Men have lived worse lives and lived on and on." The stranger touched Caspar's hand with the ruin of his own, then drew back into the crowd. In the gap he left behind, Cathy caught Caspar's questing eye. She tracked the man as he left. "My papa," Caspar said, "an apprentice." Cathy had no strength to stop him. Caspar disappeared after the man, angling his way through the mourners. By the time he breached the last of them, the man was already shambling into the hawthorn, disappearing around the looping trail. He had drawn up his collar, lost himself beneath a tall Homburg hat, and Caspar had to strain to catch up. Finally he grappled for the man's elbow. "My papa never took an apprentice," he gasped. "My brother and I, we..." "Calm yourself, boy. I didn't mean to alarm. Of course I used the word loosely. I only ever set foot in your emporium once, and by then I pray he did not recognize me. In the days I knew your papa, he was a different man. All of this was for the future. The Jacob's godman I knew was a carpenter. But he turned sticks into soldiers, just for something to do with his hands. And he... The man stopped. Your family, they are waiting for you, are they not? Casper looked over his shoulder. Kathy was watching him from the graveside. They have been waiting for me longer than I can say. They can wait a little longer. It has been a lifetime since I saw your father. But when I saw the notice of his death, I had to come and say my farewell. I believe... The man's face seemed to crumple for an instant, lending him a haggard, almost leering air. I would not be alive were it not for him. Certainly I would not be the man I am today. You might say that Jacob's godman saved my soul. He didn't know that he did it, and he never knew what I did with it. He never knew that the little soldiers he showed me how to make went with me back home. Never knew all the places I travelled to share them. Places where the children don't have any toys. Places where they deserve to be reminded. Toys made me good again. Perhaps you can understand. I had never thought of myself as a good man, not until I met your father. At the graveside, as the crowd fanned out, each to their private griefs, Kathy watched her husband embrace the stranger, then let him go off into the trees. Martha was already gone, helping Nina corral her boys, by the time Casper returned. His strides as he returned along the trail had new purpose. We should retire, back to the Emporium. Kathy was still staring after the man long after he had vanished. Who was he? She asked. Casper put his arm through hers, and together they followed the path. A stranger. Papa knew him long ago. Long before he knew either me or Emil. Halfway along the trail, where the carriages were already in sight, a thought hit Kathy, and she dug her heels into the frozen earth, straining on Casper's arm until he too came to a halt. That man, Kathy said. Did he say what his name was? Chichikov, Casper answered. Then he drew his collar up against the cold and wind. The man said his name was Chichikov. 7 days is an eon in the lives of toy soldiers. For simple wooden minds, a day might be a lifetime, a week, time beyond measure. And though they were there on the night Papa Jack passed away, their best and bravest seeking communion with him as he slipped from this world, up and down the skirting board he has already passed into legend. All they know, now, is that the old one is gone, that a season has passed with not a heart beating anywhere in the Emporium halls, and that now, the two younger gods and their families have returned. The toy soldiers lurk in the skirting boards now, silent but for the ticking of their motors, spying through thin cracks in the wood. And what they see is this. On one side of the room, the demon lord is playing with his children. On the other, the Casper god is seated with his wife and their daughter, the one who tells the soldiers truths out of books. Between them sits a table, heaped high with the foods of banquet. And not a roast potato, not a glazed carrot, not a vareniki or bowl of hot broth is being touched. Instead, the gods remain famished on the borders of the room, casting each other glances whenever the other one is unaware. And the toy soldiers think, to whom does the world belong, now that the old one is gone? Which one is it? The Lord of Light, or the Lord of Death? Are we to live in peace, or be sent back to wage the long war, from this day on and forevermore? Kathy was late to bed that night, for in the kitchens Mrs. Hornung quaked over the wasted food, the mountains of crockery, the pots and pans that needed to be scoured and stacked away. For hours they worked in companionable silence, and only once did either one speak. Her arms deep in soap suds, Mrs. Hornung uttered, "He was a good man." And after that returned to her work with newfound fire. Sometime later, when the Emporium clocks were tolling and Kathy was ready to leave, she spoke again. "Those two boys have been squabbling since they were young. But there was love in it back then. Tell me, Kathy, is there love in it now? Because all I see is hate." "There's love," said Kathy. "No understanding, but there's still love." "Well, that's boys for you. All the love in the world doesn't match a little scrap of understanding." Kathy dwelt on it as she went back above. By now, Emil and Nina had retired to their separate beds, Martha reading Pierrot to the toy soldiers in the walls. For a moment, Kathy stopped in the doorway to listen. The story was Bluebeard and the terrible chamber to which his young wife was forbidden to go. She wondered if the soldiers understood yet the horror they were hearing. Then she drifted on. Casper would be asleep by now, his back turned against her as it always was. She opened the door, and there he sat, in a whirlwind of paper dolls. They danced like sprites as he scissored them from the rolls at his side, taking off and floating like some heavenly host. He looked at her through the angelic storm. "For you," he said. They hung in the air, paper centaurs, paper nymphs. "Casper, you're awake." "I was waiting for you." "Waiting for me?" "I didn't want to sleep, Mrs. Godman. Not without you near." Words were such slippery things. She wanted to hear what she thought she was hearing, but there was so much distance between the two of them. Languages grew and changed, and perhaps the words had a different meaning when they left Casper's mouth to the moment they touched her ear. She snuffed out the light, slid under the covers. As always, the no-man's land stretched between them. "Tomorrow's a new day," she ventured. "Remember that. We'll always have new days." Something had changed in his breathing. Then she had to check herself, for this too had the quality of dream. She felt movement at her side. Casper's hand had stretched out into the no-man's land. It was reaching for hers, and she allowed it to be taken. "Kathy, there's something I have to do. You might think it frightfully absurd." The last he said with a grin, and Kathy felt certain it was not her imagination. She felt more certain still when his other hand found her, lying on her belly before gliding north. It was such a strange sensation, so unexpected, that she could not drive the tension out of her body. She flinched, recoiled, then laughed, as if she had never been touched before. "Casper, are you... You ask me if I'm well by the hour, every hour. You won't need to ask me again." He had rolled toward her, drawing her into the no-man's land. But then this, she supposed, was where everyone ought to meet. "Do you think we might try?" It was no good holding herself so rigidly. She was a part of this too. She had to force her hand up to touch Casper's face, but once she had forced it, her fingers remembered the line of his cheeks, the knots in his skin, the peculiar savageness above his left eye. The body had a memory, just like the mind. To hell with those music boxes he used to make. This, right now, was like stepping backwards in time. In the night, she woke knowing he was near, and when she rolled toward him, his arms folded around her and she felt the beating of his heart. Later, when she woke, they had come apart, each dreaming their separate dreams. But that was good. That was as it should be. And when she stretched her body, he stretched his, as if reflecting her in a mirror. For a time, the images that played across the backs of her eyes were not true dreams, but recollections, fragments of lives yet to be lived. She and Casper had a tiny emporium in Paris. where they sold patchwork frogs and the toy soldiers lived in peace. She heard the deep bass of his snoring. Then she heard silence. And until she woke up, with dawn's first light to fill the emptiness beside her, the cold air playing at her back, she had no idea that he was not there with her and had not been for hours. Caspar was gone. His slippers, his robe, the canes with which he walked, all of those things gone as well. It was not so unusual for Kathy to wake up alone, and if, after last night, she had imagined them lying together until the day was old, that was only because, on the edges of sleep, it was possible to believe that she was still the 16-year-old runaway who had first fallen into his arms, to forget the fact that she was a mother, a wife, part of the gears that kept Papa Jack's emporium alive. Perhaps it was not such a shameful thing to admit that, if only for tiny pockets in time, it was a joy to be nothing other than herself. The idea struck her that he would be in his workshop, for after last night anything seemed possible. She went there now, expecting to find him lost in some miraculous new design, but the workshop was empty, and it occurred to her now she could hear no scuttling in the walls. None of the regimented march of toy soldiers that had coloured their days for so long. Sometimes it was more reverential in Caspar's workshop, but as she returned to the quarters she crouched at the skirting, pressed her ear to the wall. In the cavities there was only silence, dull and absolute. "What are you doing down there, Mama?" She turned. Martha had been reclining on one of the armchairs all along, one of her novels in hand. "You slept there all night, little one." Martha shrugged. "Not on purpose. Is something wrong, Mama?" What could she say? Silence, Martha. Peace. Kathy lifted her robe and hurried back through the quarters, up the stair to the place where her bed lay bare. She could see the indentation Caspar's body made in the sheets, but his absence was like a vortex in the room. It pulled her down. The window was ajar, the frost of morning whispering through, but though she peered out, she did not see him hanging from a ledge, nor reclined up on the roof tiles taking in the morning air. Through the wall she heard the chatter of Emile's children. Nina was already barracking them for some imagined mischief. As she stepped back from the window, her eyes fell on Caspar's bedside table. There, beneath the lantern strewn up with dancing paper dolls, lay a letter. "Kathy," the envelope read, and the word was loaded with all the dread of the journal he used to write, the feeling of his hands on her last night, the strange new silence in the walls. "My own Kathy, by the time you find this letter, I will be gone. I dare not think of your face as you are reading these words. I dare not imagine the moment you tell Martha, my Martha, for she has always been mine, no matter what the particulars of her blood, that she will not see me again. You will not hate me for it, because your heart has always been bigger than hate. But do not think ill of yourself, should you perhaps feel a little relief. Because the truth is, I have been gone for many years already. I left you on the day I left the Emporium for those foxholes in the French earth. That I came back at all was down to you. You picked me up and put me back together. And if you could not put me back together whole, that was never your burden and never your fault. I have known for too long that I am withering away. But I now know what I must do, and though I do it with the deepest regret. For I love you, as I have only ever loved one thing, and that is the Emporium itself. In my heart and mind you are bound up with one another, and never to be prized apart. But the Emporium is in ruins, and it is me keeping it that way. And my darling, you are in ruins, and it is me keeping you that way. It is in this letter that I set you free. Live a long, rich life. Think of me often, but never with regrets. but Papa Jack's emporium must endure where I cannot. And so must you, my darling. There is a different place for me now. I am going to find it. Yours for the last time, Caspar Godman Esquire. P.S. Take care of Emil. He is going to need you now. Kathy read it once. She read it twice. She forced herself to read it again, each time more agonizingly slowly than the last. But if she had expected the words to evaporate and change, she was sorely mistaken. There they stayed, imprinted on the page, just as they were imprinting themselves on her heart. An hour passed, maybe more, but the clock had stopped ticking. The motors had wound down. She thought perhaps that she herself was winding down, until, with an enormous effort, she got to her feet. She marched to the mirror, and, God, but she looked old. "Dry your eyes, Catherine Ray," she told herself, and choked when she realized the old name had already come back to her tongue. "No," she reminded herself. "Whether you're a Godman or a Ray, you're still you. And, Kathy, you don't cry." Folding the letter neatly to place it in a pocket, she marched out onto the gallery. He was not in his workshop, but she had known that already. She crossed the silent shop floor, where no miniature locomotives hurtled along the aisles. No tramping could be heard between floorboards and shelf stack, and into the half-moon hall. She fumbled for a key and opened up the door, staggering out into the whiteness that had encrusted Iron Duke Mews. The snow had fallen thickly last night. Drifts grew up the walls of the mews, burying the doors of the neighbouring shops. It had fallen too deeply to leave any footprints, but she hastened up the mews all the same. Kathy Godman, still in her nightgown, plunging knee-deep with every step. She had gone halfway when she stumbled. There was a mound in the snow, no doubt belying the cobbles underneath, and she pitched forward as she hit it. The snow cushioned her fall, and for a time she lay there, breathing it in, the morning air, the stillness, the very last day of what she had thought was her life. She watched as a pair of newspaper men crossed the end of the mews, but they did not look in, so they did not see her lying there. Nor did they see the frosted velvet and felt that had been unearthed when she stumbled. Kathy saw it in the corner of her eye, indigo and tartan, a lolling tongue of darned sock. In an instant the numbness, surely so much more than the snow, to which she was giving herself had been swept away. In its place was fire that thawed every corner of her body. She plunged her forearms into the snow, scrabbled for purchase, shoveled handfuls away where she could not take hold. Then she heaved until the tartan and felt was lying on top of the snow, and she was staring down, down into the lifeless face of Sirius, the patchwork dog. She brushed crystals of ice away from his cross-stitched nose. She pressed her face to his belly, listened for the whirring of his heart. But the mechanisms that drove him, that had driven him ever since Caspar was a boy, had stopped. Her fingers fumbled for his belly, but nothing turned within. The key by which Sirius was wound was unnaturally still. Kathy bore the dog up. How light it was, only cotton wadding and felt, and carried it back along the mews, through the doors to the half-moon hall. There she spread its legs to see the tiny key protruding from the fabric on its underside. "Please," she whispered, and blew on her hands to warm up her fingers. Delicately she started to turn. The key caught, and she could feel the touch of the mechanism inside. Something clicked every time it revolved, but soon she came to know she was turning the key in thin air. It was not meshing with whatever contraption lay on the other side. She shifted Sirius around, petting him gently, making yet more promises as she worked. "It's all right, boy," she whispered. "He hasn't gone. He can't have gone. Not now, not after all this. He's coming back. Don't give up, not yet." Something inside Sirius's belly moved. The key had snagged on some tangle of wires. After a moment the key slipped free once again, but now that she knew what she was searching for, she knew how to find it again. Soon the key was driving the motors. She felt them coming to life, and when at last the key would turn no tighter, she fell back, collapsed onto the cold shop floor. Beside her, Sirius lay still. His motors turned, but he did not flicker, not even as if in a dream. Kathy lay back, defeated. She did not want to sob, and so she did not, but something sobbed inside her. For the end of Sirius. For Papa Jack lying cold in the ground. For the idea that she had not lost Casper today, but lost him in a thousand tiny moments ever since he returned. For the fact that she had not been able to save him, after all this time. There was a thunder of footsteps. Somebody else was on the shop floor. She looked up to see them running to her through a stand of paper trees. Emil crashed through the creeping vines, Mrs. Hornan close behind. "We saw the doors open, the snow coming in. Kathy, is everything all right?" Before she could answer, the bundle of fabric at her feet started to shift. Kathy looked down, and from between her legs there rose a cross-stitched nose, two black button eyes. Sirius turned his head, his darned sock tongue lolling out as if desperate for water. Softly his tail began to beat. He climbed ungainly to his feet. Kathy gathered him up, clung to him, as he lapped at her, leaving dust and dangling thread wherever he touched her face. She dug into her pocket and pressed the note into Emil's waiting hand. "It's Casper," she said. "He's gone. He's left us all behind." The Ghost in the Toy Shop. Papa Jack's Emporium, 1924-1940. The man's name was Lewis, and, or so it seemed to Kathy, he was more interested in the patchwork rabbits proliferating on the shelf than the letter she kept pressing into his hands. "We're here as a courtesy, Mrs. Godman, and because my chief inspector brought his daughters here once upon a while." Two other constables were somewhere in the aisles, trying to pull crinkled card berries from the paper trees. "I'm afraid that what you have there, in your hands, rather disproves your case. Your husband isn't missing, Mrs. Godman." He turned on his heel from the shelf and wiped his hand in disgust on his trouser. One of the patchwork rabbits, with precise derision, had deposited a patchwork pellet into his palm. "He just left. It's there in black and white, and little we can do about it, in a public forum at least. Listen, you have my sympathies. Before I was a copper, I was a soldier, like the lot of us, and..." Mr. Godman wouldn't be the first to walk out on his wife. "If you had my job, why, you'd know some of the terrible things that can happen when a soldier comes home." Kathy said, "You don't know my husband." "We done some digging, Mrs. Godman. All as a favour, you understand. He was a flamboyant man, your husband. That's what his old soldier pals tell us. Up and down, that sort of fella. And that can be the worst. And you knew, of course, what he was doing down at the veterans' home, down on the Strand with those music boxes of his." Kathy stopped herself before she replied. She had thought those music boxes a thing of the past. "Oh, yes. His trips down there seemed to have been quite the stir. Music boxes for all the veterans, things to make them feel young again. But you knew about that, of course." The sergeant loped back into the Half Moon Hall, poked his head out of the door and peered up the snowbound mews. "And the dog, you say you found it out there?" "He must have followed Casper out, then lain down in the snow." "What, and just froze to death?" "I wound him back up. He..." "I see. One of your contraptions, then, was it? Not quite real. Mrs. Godman, you can understand where I'm coming from. You say the dog followed him out, and yet you still say he's missing." "Well, if a man leaves of his own accord..." Kathy propped herself against one of the shelves. There was no use in arguing with somebody so blinkered, so instead she just nodded. "Might I ask you a personal question, Mrs. Godman? I'm told it has relevance, though Lord knows you'll think I'm a ghoul." Kathy said, "If you think it will help," and noticed the man could not even look her in the eye. When did you and your husband last have... There is no savoury way of saying this. Relations. Is that a proper question, Sergeant? Not improper, Mrs. Godman. It may shed some light. Propriety says I ought to be ashamed, thought Cathy. Ashamed to stand here in front of this man and even entertain his question. But even in that place her mother tried to take her, Cathy had refused to feel ashamed. I'll answer, Mr. Lewis, this one and nothing more. My husband and I were together on the night that he left. The sergeant nodded. He was saying goodbye. You can be certain of that. It's a thing with some men. One for the road, as they say. I'm sorry, Mrs. Godman. Look, we'll take a picture, if we may. We'll open a file, all in the way of a favour, you understand. The sergeant called out for his constables and idled there while he waited. Before I go, I wonder, and this being unprofessional, I know, if I might take a little something. I have a nephew on the coast. His parents have promised him a journey to your emporium many Christmases now, and yet... The sergeant shrugged, and in that shrug was all the indifference in the world. Just a little trinket, perhaps a little toy soldier. I'm afraid we have none. The sergeant glowered. Papa Jack's emporium and not a single toy soldier? It seems my husband took them, each and every one. The sergeant nodded. So slowly it seemed he was testing her. I suppose you believe they just picked themselves up and marched after him. And Cathy, to whom the silence was still so strange, thought, if only you knew. She watched them go from the doorway, knowing in her heart they would not return. As they reached the end of Iron Duke Mews, no doubt already debating the dogs down at Dagenham, Cathy pictured how it might have been 7 nights ago, as Caspar loped the same way. In her mind she saw him turning the corner, and Sirius, torn between his loyalty to his master and the Emporium itself, left howling in his wake. Running away, she remembered now, was not like it was in the stories. People did not try and stop you. They did not give chase. The thing people didn't understand was that you had to decide what you were running away from. Most of the time it wasn't husbands or wives or monsters or villains. Most of the time you were running away from that little voice inside your head, the one telling you to stay where you are, that everything will be all right. But it would have been, she thought as she slammed the door. She would have gone to the end with him, even if he'd never let her touch her again, even if all he'd wanted to do was to stay in his workshop and make his toys. She had wanted to be the one who was with him on the day that he died, when the sentry had grown older and the two of them had grown older too. But now that hope was gone, and, gazing up, the Emporium lay empty before her. 2 weeks since he'd gone, and she felt like one of London's vagrants, sitting on a street corner grateful for any crust. There was still snow left in Hyde Park. She came out of St. George's on the corner, decorating every lamppost and tree from the Serpentine to the Apsley Gate with the posters she and Martha had laboured over. Come home, Caspar, hung from every bough. In the heart of Mayfair, where she had planted one of his paper trees, people gathered for the spectacle and came away with a letter in their hands. If you see this man, deliver this promise. I still love you, no matter what. She went down to the veterans' homes where they said he had taken his music boxes. She dug out the addresses of old soldiers, anyone whose path might have crossed his. She wrote to shop hands past and present, thinking of all the places he might go. She took the train to the estuary, for mightn't Caspar, deranged in his way, have thought to find a new life in her old one, just as she had found one in his. But the letters came back. Dear Cathy, I have seen neither hide nor hair, and the trips were in vain. 19 hours and 15 days. 3 hours, 3 weeks. Spring and summer and autumn and winter again. Somewhere along the way she stopped going out to hand out pamphlets. The tree in Berkeley Square grew heavy with rain and crumpled to a thick, sticky mulch. Emile said they could hardly afford another full page in the Times. Not until they began the hard work of repairing the Emporium's reputation. Cathy left the tradesman's door unlocked each night, just in case he returned. Until one day Mrs. Hornung noticed the wet footprints in the Windward aisles and deduced, to Emile's horror, that crooks had crept in and stolen a whole crate of magic carpets. After that, Cathy just waited. And waiting was the most lonesome thing. She woke in the night, an idea dragging her from dreams. The journal Papa Jack had given her was still in the trunk beneath the bed. She heaved it out, daring not to open it in case this dream was to be shattered. It was almost dawn by the time she opened the journal, and finding no note from Caspar there, took a pen and scribbled herself. "Caspar, my dearest Caspar, are you there? Wherever you are, wherever you went, it can be undone." But when, 3 months later, the pages scoured each night, there was no reply. She placed the journal back in the chest beneath the bed, and never did open it again. It was not the silence of her papa that Martha missed in those months, for heaven knows he had been silent long enough. It was the silence in the walls that kept her up at night. Silence, she was starting to realize, could be as oppressive as snow. Martha put away her Gulliver's Travels, her Charles Perrault and Arabian Nights on the day the soldiers disappeared. Reading alone was not enough, not when there were once 100 wooden faces hanging on every word. The books on the shelf spoke of happier times, of Martha on Caspar's knee as he told great fables which she later realized he had entirely made up. Of the soldiers waiting for every twist and turn, the stories seeping into their sandalwood minds, teaching them, ordering them, programming them with this business of life. At night the silence weighed on her. The peace frightened her. 17 years old, she slept in her mama's bed, in the place where her papa used to lie. "They can't all have gone, can they?" she said one night, to the impenetrable dark. "All those hundreds of them. All those thousands, however many lived up and down the walls, he can't have taken them all, can he?" All he would have needed, Cathy thought, was one of his bags, like the one he made for me when Martha was born. Open it up and let them all march into its depth. And off they would go, out into the world. But at least that would mean he was alive. At least that might mean he was not rotting at the bottom of the Thames, like all the rest of the missing. Or the dispossessed. That first year the shop hands came long before first frost. Emile sent notices out, and now here they were, with new storemen and down-and-out stevedores, all dragged in to set the Emporium to rights. On the shop floor the workers were wrenching up the aisles. Nina and the boys were marshalling the patchwork reindeer to heave the shipping containers out of the storerooms so that Emile might make an inventory of all they had left. There were enough toys here of Papa Jack's and Caspar's design to keep the shelves full for the next winter, more still if they rationed them well, and Emile worked hard to supplement them with toys of his own. In places they tore down the barricades, Mrs. Hornung levered up every stretch of railroad track the toy soldiers had lain. The shop hands reconstructed the aisles in such a way that the shop floor would seem smaller and yet more packed with excitement than these last winters, when the soldiers had run amok. Foresters were brought in to fell the paper trees, now yellow and sagging with age, while the Wendy House, still boarded up, was loaded up and hauled away. "We'll refit it next winter," said Emile, when he saw how Cathy was staring. "It's not gone forever, Cathy, I promise." But perhaps it ought to be, she thought. Those four walls, so loaded with memory. Perhaps what she needed was not to see it sitting there every day. Speaking of happier times. She returned to an aisle where she worked alone, dusting down old dancing bears. At its end, the shelf stacks had been torn up, revealing a great moor in the wall where the masonry had crumbled away. There Martha called out for her mamma. Cathy went down into the shadows and crouched at Martha's side. Behind the crumbled wall lay one of the cavities where the soldiers used to march. The light from Martha's lantern spilled over the open face of a doll's house. Tiny paper trees had sprouted in its garden, stunted by the dark. "Look, Mama." Martha had prized up one of the floorboards. Along the piping underneath, the toy soldiers had laid out a field. And in that field, tiny stones had been arranged.
"Is that
letters?" Martha realized. "For the stones at her feet might, if she squinted just right, spell out the single word, hello." "I was trying to show them," she said, as the men behind her took joy in dragging out 6 feet of underground railway. "I'd remembered how Uncle Amir proposed. I thought, why not? If they could understand, they could learn to talk back. If only there was more time, perhaps there could have been a parley. Perhaps they might have understood. Uncle Emil isn't a monster. He isn't the tyrant they thought he was. Perhaps we could have understood each other, if only we could have talked." Kathy had been crouching. In the garden of one of the crudely built houses she found a minuscule figure, no bigger than the nail of her little finger. She lay it in her palm and brought it to the light. Splinters, trussed up and twisted into the shape of a ballerina. They were making their own toys.
"Toys for toys," laughed Martha. "Maybe one day they'd have learned to wind themselves too. Maybe they'd have woken up, then made toys of their own, even tinier ones, tiny toys out of motes of dust.
Maybe they'd have woken up too.
And maybe, just maybe, all we are, every last one of us, is a toy brought to life."
"You're starting to sound religious."
"Papa would have liked the idea, wouldn't he, Mama?"
"Well, wouldn't he?"
Kathy lay the tiny ballerina back in the dark, where it surely belonged.
"What are we going to do, Mama?"
Kathy fingered the ruin, the world where the soldiers used to live.
"We're going to wait," she said, "and we're going to believe."
Papa Jack's Emporium, Iron Duke Mews, 18th of February, 1925. Dear Mr. Molliet, please find enclosed the balance sheets drawn up for the winter season 1924-25. As you will see, the Emporium did not run at profit and will require further hard work to rejuvenate, but rest assured that the work is being undertaken. Next winter will be a triumph. Yours sincerely, Emil Godman, Esquire.
Papa Jack's Emporium, Iron Duke Mews, 20th of January, 1926.
Dear Mr. Molliet, please find enclosed the balance sheets drawn up for the winter season 1925-26. Might I impose upon you to extend our credit arrangement in anticipation of next season, when we stalwart Emporium few will return our Emporium to the giddy heights of yore. Yours sincerely, Emil Godman, Esquire.
Papa Jack's Emporium, Iron Duke Mews, 6th of June 1927.
Mr. Molliet, I am sick and tired of the doggerel I receive through my letterbox and the unannounced visits from your associates at the bank. We are late in our annual accounting. Do you not think I have better things to be doing than totting up numbers that don't mean a thing? I was here this winter. I know how the Emporium fares. Please find enclosed the balance sheets. Blank, because I have toys to make, and, lest this be forgotten, my business is in making toys and not playing lip service to a moneylender. E.G.
Papa Jack's Emporium, Iron Duke Mews, 18th of June, 1927.
Dear Mr. Molliet, I received your letter and apologize for mine written in haste. We look forward to your visit and what new arrangements we are able to work out. I remain optimistic that, with a little help, our Emporium will once again be a fixture in London life. Yours in gratitude, Emil Godman, Esquire.
The snowdrops blossomed early in the year of 1928, and thank heavens for small mercies, for Emil could not stand another day, another night, another customer who looked him bare in the face and said, "Ah, there used to be such magic." Now he sat on the floor in his papa's old study, all of the shelves denuded of their books, pages of designs he could barely understand splayed out all around.
The chest with a thousand legs had been snapping at him from under the armchair all night. The phoenix, who had refused to leave the room ever since the old man died, was wound down, but watched him nevertheless from its roost in the rafters. But Emile was lost in a world that did not belong to him, searching for a design, an idea, a something that might make it all worthwhile. January became February, became March and April. All the ideas of Papa Jack's life came down like an avalanche around Emile. He spent his days braced for the next deluge, holding his breath. Sometimes he fell asleep there, and sometimes he woke there too. He marvelled at the designs for the first patchwork bears, but when he tried to recreate them, they were dull, dumb things with barely a character among them. He unearthed plans for the foldaway fortress of 1901, the door through the wall of 1898, the infinity of Russian dolls of 1911. He lost a month in hewing a new line of runnerless rocking horse, but the brutes were intractable, refused to take a rider, and had, in the end, to be added to a pyre or dismantled for scrap. Sometimes the only time he spoke to another living soul was when Mrs. Horning arrived with his supper, and sometimes not even then. He thought it was Mrs. Horning tonight, loitering in the study door with a bowl of pea soup and a hunk of hard bread. That was why at first he did not turn around. He was sailing in a sea of books, and the blueprint unrolled before him was for a Minotaur, lost in its labyrinth. This one he might even be able to attempt. He was picturing how it might be done, when a cough alerted him to the fact that his wife was waiting. She hadn't even brought supper. "Emile, we have to talk." "I can't, not yet, not now. It's in here somewhere, Nina. One of these toys. Something he dreamt up but didn't see through. Well, we'll see it through. Who cares if it isn't mine? Who'll know? We'll find a way to make it every bit as magical as they would have done, and fill the shop floor." He looked up, dewy-eyed. "There are still 6 months until Christmas." "Four, Emile." Emile tore at the blueprint, scything it apart with his hands. Four. How had he not known it was four? Nina swept the papers off his papa's armchair and sat down. "Do you realize," she said, "how long it's been since you read to your boys? How many hours you've been down here? Do you realize," she went on, punctuating each word with the point of her finger, "how long it's been since you played with your own sons?" Emile looked as if he might answer, but Nina quickly cut him off. 3 weeks, and before that, 5. There they are, upstairs, and here you are, oblivious.
Oblivious? Good God, Nina, what do you think I'm here for? Do you think I want to be here every night, poring through this? Every page a reminder of how useless, how ordinary I am. How witless would you have to be to think I'd want that? I'm doing it for them, Nina. I'm doing it for you.
You're not as foolish as that, Emile. Doing it for me. The Emporium in tatters and your name signed on a mortgage deed. No, you're doing it for you. Doing it for us would have been to take that offer from Hamley's. Go and make toys for them and be paid well enough. Staying here? That's for... She shook her head. You, a toy maker, the best toy maker left in London, and you won't even play with your own boys. Best, Emile uttered, but evidently not good enough. She stood. She dusted down her house dress. She said, "I'm leaving you, Emile." There was silence in the study. Emile rose to his feet, with his papa's design sloughing off him like a skin being shed. "Nina." "No," she said, and refused to catch his eye as she marched out into the hall. "We have had this conversation too many times. You're not a father. You're not a husband. You're a little boy still looking for magic." "Well, what about the ordinary magic, Emile? The ordinary magic of simply being a good father? Those boys deserve better. We're to stay with my aunts." "That coven? For my boys?" "We'll find our own home in good course. I have a cousin who has promised his help. It won't be easy, but at least it can be a start. All of this, and she opened her arms as if to take in a meal, the study, the whole emporium itself. It's a long, slow end. He did not argue with her. He slammed the door, and once his tears were spilled, he marched into his boy's bedroom and spun them the most fantastic tale of a dumpy little boy who didn't know he was a prince, and a magic sword lying at the bottom of a toy box, and a castle that the prince conquered, a heritage that was rightfully his. 2 weeks later, the boys lined up in the Half Moon Hall, while their mamma arranged for their trunks to be ferried to the taxicab waiting outside. They looked smart in their short trousers and blazers, each with a little Gladstone bag at their side. Emil approached each in turn and stiffly shook their hands. To Kathy it looked as if each boy might suddenly bleat out, but whatever they were feeling, they were adept at keeping it in. Something, no doubt, they had inherited from their father. Nina was back in the doorway, summoning them out. "Be good for your mamma," Emil uttered as they filed out into Iron Duke Mews. As they left, Kathy put an arm around Emil, and he shrunk into her. "They'll be back, won't they, Kathy? Once the Emporium lives again, once the Emporium thrives, then I'll be able to instruct lawyers, I'll bring all the wealth of the Emporium to bear, and then they'll be here, playing in these aisles just like it's meant to be." 1929. 1930, 1931. Pursuant to the Births and Deaths Registration Act 1874. Death in the sub-district of Westminster, London, United Kingdom of England and Wales. Caspar Godman, born May the 24th, 1888, foreign national, died January 12th, 1931, in absentia. Male, 43 years old, by his own hand. Certified to be a true copy of an entry in the certified copy of a register of deaths in the district mentioned above. Kathy was rigid as she folded the paper and pressed it back into the envelope. She thought she might let it flutter down over the Emporium in 1,000 tiny pieces, just like that confetti snow they used to be able to afford. Lurking, unshaven behind her, Emil bided his time before he spoke. "We had to observe it, Kathy. You understand, don't you? If they make the Emporium mine by the deeds, Lloyds will start lending again. Mr. Moyliette made me a promise. They couldn't possibly lend to a man who'd been missing so long. But now that they can, well, we can get things back to the way they used to be. You and me, Kathy, together we can do it." Kathy handed him the paper. "I won't believe it. What they've written there." "Oh," said Emil, "you won't have to. As a matter of fact, I..." He floundered, some memory of his brother no doubt flurrying up. "Won't believe it either. But it's only paper. Doesn't have to be true. You and me, we can believe what we want to believe. Just so long as there are customers at Christmas and the cloud castles floating on air. Just so long as there are festivities on opening night." Papa Jack's Emporium, Iron Duke Mews, 16th of October, 1934. "Dear Francis," wrote Kathy, and then on a separate leaf, "Dear Sally Ann, it has come to that time of year again when we look to first frost. Some nights I feel it in the air, and I know you will be waking every morning too, looking for that telltale crust of white that has for so long told us our winter has begun. But I have news, and believe me when I tell you that this is a letter I had hoped never to write. Papa Jack's Emporium will indeed open at first frost, but we will not be inviting our shop hands to return. This winter Emil will labour in his workshop while Martha and I alone work the shop floor. It is the slow creep of the ages, which you have seen with your own eyes. We have sold the very last paper tree from the storerooms. All of the patchwork animals are gone, and what dogs and cats and sheep and bears Emil makes now are no more magical than the ones they engineer in any other toy shop in London town, and twice as expensive to boot. We have boxes of bric-a-brac, and Emil is not short of new designs, but the wherewithal to produce them en masse evades us. And we rely so heavily on credit.